This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Well, oh my God, God angry on his throne. The angels in the heaven, they begin to moan. Hold down the angels, stir up a flood. Blow out the sun, change the moon into blood. Come back, angels, bar the door. For I declare the time will be no more. They tell me, great God, when it started to rain, the women and the children, they begin to scream. Knocked on the windows, battered at the door, crying, oh, brother Noah, can't you take on more? Noah said, I'm sorry, my friend, but God's got the key and you can't come in.
Well, Noah was worried about the children coming in, but he wanted to hear the angels moan.
Well, didn't it rain? God's gonna
send the water from Zion.
He's gonna rain
heaven up higher. It's gonna rain. It's gonna rain.
The extra stress of record weather is happening even during COVID-19 and while millions of people are losing their jobs. To understand and prepare for this new climate threat, don't count on mainstream media to tell you where the new climate is already emerging. The early signs may be literally at the far ends of the earth, like rampant heat in Siberia this year, or Antarctica's record warming. The future may show up in a deep forest or in densely populated places in Asia. During summer, in the northern or southern hemisphere, we imagine global warming as heat, often with drought and extreme wildfires. That's the picture. In the late spring of 2020, the American South was instead drenched with storm after storm. In China, the awful new future appeared as extreme rainfall event, stuff nobody had heard of. Aerial footage shows cities and villages in China along the mighty Yangtze River and its 50 tributaries almost completely submerged by days of record-breaking, powerful rain all over the region. You've hardly heard about it. The origin city for COVID-19, Wuhan, went through days of astounding record-setting rainfall in the first days of July. Further upstream, floods poured in, reaching the Three Gorges Reservoir on July 2nd. The flow was too great to be contained. The floodgates were opened. Cities downstream were drowned, along with hundreds of people dead. The world's largest hydroelectric dam, the Three Gorges, over the Yangtze, is one of the bottlenecks for this wave of extraordinary water. The authorities warn Three Gorges cannot prevent more flooding downstream. So when the massive dam was built, that was part of the promise. Three Gorges would control the Yangtze flooding, which it had done for centuries and bedeviled the cities along that great river. Now perhaps the dam could have controlled historic water levels and the resulting floods. But nothing in modern infrastructure, including dams in your country, anticipated the amounts of rain and snow possible when the atmosphere warms so rapidly. Nothing was engineered for the developing new climate, not dams, not drainage systems, not highways, suburbs, or cities, nothing. At the same time, more record rains have flooded about one-third of the entire country of Bangladesh. This was not rising seas, but inland rains causing rivers to overflow, displacing millions of people. This alone would be a major story in any other time but this. Listeners in many parts of the world can remember unheard-of floods in the last 10 or 15 years. 1-in-1,000-year events have returned within a decade in some places. The extreme rains may come with a named storm like Hurricane Irene in New England. It may come as a monsoon in India or Bangladesh, or just wild, unexpected rains like those that hit the capital of Canada, Ottawa, a few years ago, or in Japan just this past spring. Incredible stuff. Inland America and Prairie Canada have been inundated too many times in recent years. Global warming has drastically changed the rains and the rivers already, and we are just getting started in times of weather we have never seen before. People, it is simple physics. A hotter atmosphere can hold more water vapor. Whatever goes up must come down, and now all over the world, when it rains, it floods. You need to know the emerging truth about extreme precipitation events. Record rains are popping up all over the world, flooding inland areas faster than rising seas. We see videos of flooded streets, floating cars, and maybe a house dragged down the river, and then it disappears from the media landscape as quickly as the rains themselves. But the damages last for years. People must move or try to build new defenses if they can, and lives are lost forever. Even in these days of heat, even when the spring has passed, we must expect and prepare for that long-term extreme precipitation events. A hard rain is going to fall. Fortunately, we have the experts to explain. I've collected two of the best for your summer listening.
Radio EcoShock.
River floods already displace more people within countries than any other cause, and they affect far more people than other disasters. New science reveals humans will have to prepare and adapt much harder for even more river flooding in the next 20 years due to climate change. Our guest is a scientist with many roles. Dr. Anders Leverman is professor of dynamics at the climate system at Potsdam University in Germany. He is a leader at the renowned Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, or PIC. He's an adjunct scientist at Columbia University in New York and lead author of the latest IPCC chapter on sea level change. He's a journal editor and more. Dr. Leverman is co-author of a new paper, Adaptation Required to Preserve Future High-End River Flood Risk at Present Levels, as published in Science Advances January 10, 2018. Anders Leverman, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I know you're busy, so let's get right to the new paper you co-authored. Why pour so much work into studying river flooding?
Well, river flooding is actually one of the most devastating causes for damages that are caused meteorologically on the planet. And actually, meteorological damages are the strongest damages. If you ask the Munich Re, an insurance company who has the longest record for insured damages on the planet, as far as I know. So meteorological damages are important. They will most likely become more intense under global warming.
Have extreme rainfall events and floods already increased since the 1970s?
It's quite difficult if you ask for the statistics. We have been, and a lot of people still do this, which I think is important and very valid, but if we actually wait for the statistics to be done so that we can make a scientific statement that extreme events have increased in intensity or in frequency, it's generally already too late to a certain extent. I know that this is not a very popular way to put it, because a lot of people work on the statistics of weather extremes, and they should continue to do so. But society needs answers before they have already experienced this intensification. And that's why I very much appreciate that more and more people and more research is actually now focusing on the physical mechanisms of weather extremes. You know, that has been done for a long time, but it's done more and more. And we start to slowly understand why things become more intense. And that's why I'm giving not a very straight answer here. I realize this. But my point is that I don't really care whether they have intensified or not, because I know they will most likely become more intense under warming. And that is for very simple physical reasons. First of all, warmer temperatures, we have more evaporation on the planet. And the water that we put into the atmosphere has to get out again. There is water, obviously, in the atmosphere, and there better be, but there's a lot of water that the atmosphere can hold. So everything that evaporates has to fall down again. So we'll have more rainfall under global warming. In addition to that, we have a warmer water, and that's, again, Claudius Clapeyron equation, a very simple physics. A warmer atmosphere can hold more water vapor and thereby can transport more water. And you know what we find, and that is actually statistics, and that's actually what we can understand. It, we find that extreme rainfall events increase with the saturation value of how much water you'd actually have in the atmosphere. And that's why we have two good reasons why intense rainfall events and thereby flooding will intensify under global warming. And we've seen a degree of warming, so there has been an intensification that is not so easily found statistically, that physically they should have been.
Well, I'm certainly seeing it in the news. I know from reporting 10, 20 years ago that there just weren't that many extreme records for precipitation, whether it's rain or snow, being set, as I've had to report more recently. But that's just an experience. It's not an official scientific statistic. Before we go deeper into this, are we just talking about river flooding for people in faraway countries, or will industrialized nations in America and Europe also have to make adjustments and changes for this?
Well, we have an identification of the hydrological cycle. And what's very important in our study was that we focused only on the next 25 to 30 years. And the reason for that, generally, you know, climate scientists, and that's me included, are looking for this century, to the end of the century, because the climate change is a long-term problem. And this is where, you know, this is the century in which we have to mitigate the climate change and really change our energy system globally. But in this study, we used the fact that the next 25 to 30 years of global warming have already been caused by the emissions of the last decades up to a century. And that's a very dangerous statement to make for, you know, if you don't listen carefully, because it does not mean that it doesn't matter what we do in the next 25 or 30 years. Because what we do in the next 25 or 30 years will determine what is happening after 2040. And, you know, once 2040 arrives, we can't do anything about it anymore. We have to act now. So this was, again, a long answer. But what I'm saying is, in our study, we looked at the next 25 to 30 years. And that's why we can make an actual prediction about the intensification of river floods. And what we found is that river floods increase around the planet. But if you look at the adaptation, so also in the U.S. and also in Europe, but if you look at the need for adaptation, something interesting happens. The need of adaptation, and we defined it in such a way that we said, what do you have to do in order for the risk of floods in the next 25 years to be the same as the risk of floods that you had in the last 25 years. And what comes into play here is that different countries have different risk aversion. So in Europe, we are better protected against floods than in India or Indonesia. In the U.S., you have actually among the best protection, and you are used to this kind of protection. Now, if you want to keep this protection in the U.S., you have to do as much as we have to do in Germany in order to keep our level, and as much as people in India and Indonesia have to do to keep their level of protection. So that takes into account that different societies have set their protection level, their need or their desire for security at different levels. And since the U.S. has a very high level, you know, if you want to keep it, you have to work for it.
Now, this paper is free in full text online, and there's some great graphics with it. And in those graphics, it shows that there are new areas where people will experience floods in the 2030s that did not experience them in that period from 1971 to 2004. Where are some of those new flood areas?
Well, that is actually in a lot of regions in the United States. Since the flood here is defined as exceeding the flood protection level, you know, most of the regions in the U.S. are protected against floods. But overall, if you would do nothing, if you would not increase further protection because, for example, the administration doesn't take climate change seriously, then the U.S. overall increases the number of affected people by a factor of 9. So there will be nine times more people affected by floods in the next 25 years than there were in the last 25 years. These numbers are lower for China. You know, it's only about a doubling there. And they're tremendously high for the United Kingdom with a factor of almost 30. And Indonesia, India, and also Germany is quite high. So we really have to do something in order to stay protected.
Yes, the interesting thing in the United States is that some of the areas where projected flooding is really going to increase look to be in the Ohio River Valleys, the Mississippi River Valleys, in states that actually voted for President Trump, who doesn't believe in climate change. One interesting sidelight I noticed, though, that in California, there's been a lot of discussion about whether a mega flood could happen there as happened in the 1800s. And there seemed to be some disagreement amongst the climate models about the impacts of this in California. Could you talk to us about that?
Yeah, if you have a look at our study, it was close to call. That's what you would call it. The uncertainty in California and in large parts of the west of the United States was so big that we were not able to make a definite statement, and that shows you that there is a lot of uncertainty here. What is kind of an important lesson from our study, but from others, of course, it's not a special study in this, is that you can protect against climate change to a certain extent. You know, sea level rise can be protected against by dikes, by coastal protection. All kinds of methods are available. But if you don't protect yourself, then the impacts are really devastating. You know, that's why we get these large numbers. That's why we get, an eightfold or ninefold increase in the number of affected people. If you don't do anything, if you think about it, it makes a lot of sense. For example, with sea level, it's a different problem, but it's also a flooding problem. If your dike is simply too low for the sea level that you have, for the ocean height, world's ocean height, then you get tremendously, a large number of extra effects, extra impacts. And the number of affected people increases dramatically. And this is the same here with river floods. We were actually, in our study, not able to make a lot of statements about the Western U.S.
It's very distressing to see that the equatorial area of Africa will face even greater river flooding because places like the Congo are already poor and poorly governed, if not at war. What changes are coming for that region, or for Africa, let's say, in the coming climate deluges?
Africa is complicated, with respect to rain. We found, for example, that there was in a different study, but we found in 7 of the 21 climate models that did these simulations for the UN climate report. In 7 of these models, a monsoon system actually developed in the southern Sahel zone, which is at the moment a desert or close to a desert. So there's very, very little rain. And if you look at the countries, these include countries like Mali, which have civil wars at the moment, which are in unrest, and it's a terrible situation in a lot of these countries. And you would think that monsoon rainfall, that is a regular seasonal rainfall, would be a good thing for the region. And I'm actually sure it would. But having said that, and any changes that are sudden pose a problem, at least in the beginning. That is something that you can't, I'm not saying from a climate science perspective, but, having thought that, working on societal problems too, if you think of it, if you have a sudden change in the climate, that is generally a problem because it is inducing changes in society. We'll see a lot of fluctuations in Africa, and studies have found that whenever there are climate fluctuations, you have a higher chance of societal response or unrest.
And about one-third of Pakistan went underwater in 2010 due to river flooding. What happens in Asia in the 2030s, according to your new science?
Well, Pakistan was flooded in 2010 and again in 2011. This was a special event. These were two special events which were caused by what, in the U.S. is they often called the polar vortex. It was caused by a meandering of the jet stream, which led to a blockage situation, which led to a 4 to 6 weeks long hot period over Russia, including Moscow, and a lot of peatland burning there or smoldering. And at the same time, a low-pressure system in Pakistan, which created the largest freshwater lake on the planet, and was a disaster. And the next year, it happened again. These kind of events are, if anything, underestimated in our climate model. Because our climate models, they are made, they, you know, they're averaging out the weather in general. That's not, you know, they're not weather prediction models. So we tend to underestimate these extreme events. And we've tried to correct for this a little bit in our study, but there is, you know, a general conviction that the problem will be worse than is predicted by the climate models. And this is also the feeling, as you, I mentioned earlier, the feeling that a lot of people have. So if we already have a problem, if we see a problem in our models, then there probably is a problem. Specifically for Asia, we have the strongest signal in India, which is close to Pakistan, has more people, and Indonesia, which sees a 26-fold increase in affected people if nothing is done. And for these poor people, for these poor countries, it is actually a challenge to protect their population.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith. My guest is Professor Anders Levermann from Potsdam, Germany. We're talking about humans, how they all over the world will have to prepare for coming floods as the climate shifts. I found this paper very conservative in its underlying assumptions, and probably for science that's the way it has to be. I mean, one of the issues is the assumptions based on population that it would be static, and yet we know we're adding another 83 million more humans a year. Why would you choose a static population model for this study?
Yes, that's a very important thing. So the number of affected people will increase beyond the numbers that we put in the model because, as you said, the number of people overall is increasing. We, for the main statement of the paper, which was how much do we have to increase the protection in order to stay at the same risk level in the future as we had it in the past, we only used the relative number of affected people. And so that would have only been changed by a change in the density structure, in the relative density structure of the population. And since we don't have very good means to predict this at the moment, you know, people who work on this, and I trust in this research, but still, we thought that we stay, to a certain extent, we stay on the natural side of this problem and just say, well, if people don't move away, if they stay where they are, which is a reasonable assumption for the next 25 years, then this is the outcome that you'll have to protect in this way. And another reason is, by the way, that the planning for the protection, for the adaptation is done now. So a lot of municipalities will work with the data they have now.
Well, that does make sense, but people are moving. I mean, about 3 million people a week are moving into cities out of rural areas. There is a mass migration underway. Your study does look at a number of big cities that will be strongly affected by river flooding in the next couple of decades. Another question here, the expected increase in extreme precipitation events, does that figure into this study? I mean, you talk about a 1 in 100-year flood. But what if that becomes one in 30 years or even once every decade? Does the study, is it able to account for those kinds of possibilities?
So many interviews on this, and this is something that no one asked. I think that is perfect. You're a really good interviewer. Yes, well, this is actually at the core of the study. Yes, it does. That's what actually, you know, we use a climate model, which we then feed into what we call bias correct for weather extremes so that it can reproduce the past weather extremes properly so that we hope that we can have some hope that it will reproduce the future weather extremes properly. And then we feed this into our river routing schemes and discharge models, which have a very high resolution. Then we look, you know, at even a higher resolution at the flooded areas and compare this to the density of the population. So at the core, there's actually the climate model, which is accounting for these increases in the, well, to a certain extent, to the increase in frequency and intensity of floods.
Now, Anders Levermann, you led the reporting by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change on sea level rise. Does this study on river flooding include the growing damages from storm surges running up those rivers?
No, it doesn't. It's really separate, and there's a lot to be done there. We actually have to learn a lot about coastal flooding too. A lot of people work on this. There's intense and important work done there, and we are not quite finished on how the sea level will actually rise. We think we can make good statements about the next few decades, but sea level rise is a long-term problem. It's something that we cause now and will go on for hundreds of years. You know, as we now remember, or some of us remember the Roman Empire, as you know, the Romans that gave us the aqueducts and certain, and the Greeks that gave us democracy. In the same way, we will be remembered in 2,000 years as the guys who started the sea level rise, which is still continuing. So sea level is a long-term problem, and we have not figured out yet how fast it will unfold, especially beyond the next few decades. So I think for 20, 30 years, we can make a statement, but beyond that, it's difficult. To actually compute what will be flooded and what has to, you know, where protection is necessary is a very difficult problem. I know that people around the U.S. work on this, especially in San Francisco. I'm very impressed by the work of the local authorities. But yeah, it's not included here, and it'll worsen the problem.
And your study looks at what adaptation will be needed to survive in the first half of this century. But if we can't implement the emissions controls, say, by the Paris Accord, is it possible that river floods will just become totally unmanageable in the second half of this century?
Well, you can always leave behind your houses and your regions, you know. But if you think about it, that also is true for sea level rise. If we continue to emit carbon as we have done so in the past, and we continue beyond now, and we don't keep the Paris Climate Accord, then the United States will lose about 10% of its land mass eventually to sea level rise. Now, assume that another country would come and say, "We take 10% of your land away." I don't think the U.S. would take this lightly, would they? And that's not the U.S. only, and no country on the planet would take it lightly if someone takes away their land. But here, we emit carbon, and we expand the oceans by the warming atmosphere, and we melt the ice on the planet. And we just, by that, give up land, our land, to the sea. Some countries would actually be affected in an existential way, in the sense that they will be just gone, the small island states in the Pacific. And other countries will just lose important coastal areas, you know, like in Florida, obviously, but the Florida Keys, you know, they will most likely not be able to protect the Florida Keys, but also New York and San Francisco get problems. They don't have to vanish, but they get problems. And the same will be with river floods. With river floods, it's more complicated because they come suddenly. There's no, slowly increasing sea level that you can see, increasing and you can protect against. They're coming suddenly. So if you don't take the science as serious, and if you don't protect in accordance with the science, then it's really dangerous for the lives of the population.
As we wrap up, many of us are concerned that government-funded climate science is being dismantled and defunded in the United States and in Australia. We need to hear that Europe, China, and other countries can continue the science we need. Could you just briefly tell us, what is the Potsdam Institute and what does it work on?
Well, the Potsdam Institute is working on all parts of the climate problem. We have a physical unit, if you like, and that's including me, but we also have biologists and sociologists, political scientists, economists, and try to capture the essence of it, of all the different angles of climate change. Because as you see already here, climate mitigation is a societal problem. We have to solve this without causing harm to the economy globally. Yeah? We have to switch the entire energy system of the planet to renewable energies, because as long as we emit carbon, the carbon stays in the atmosphere practically forever, and as long as we do this, we increase the temperature of the planet. So there is a societal aspect to it, and we work on this. But there's also a societal aspect to adaptation. You know, the climate impacts generally occur at one place, so you could say that adaptation is a local phenomenon. But the moment you include some kind of justice into the equation, it becomes a non-local, it becomes a global question, because the people who suffer most from it, from climate change, are not necessarily the ones that cause the problem. And in the future, we will have to really harvest the entire creativity and innovative power of the planet in order to face this problem in adaptation. And for this, we need a global scheme and global incentive scheme, which is complicated, I guess, and we'll have to make it robust. And these are the problems that we work on in Potsdam.
Professor Anders Levermann is from Potsdam University in Germany and the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. He also works with Columbia University in New York. We've been discussing an important new paper published in the journal Science Advances. The title is Adaptation Required to Preserve Future High-End River Flood Risk at Present Levels. You can find links to all of this in my show blog at ecoshock.org, published every Wednesday. Anders, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
No, it was great. You're very, very informed. I'm very impressed. And thanks a lot, for getting so deep into our study. I mean it. It's really great. And thanks.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
This is a Best of Radio EcoShock replay with experts on land flooding from extreme rainfall events. It's hardly a newscast these days without weather porn. In January 2017, it was Houston flooding, mudslides in California, and an Oregon town or two with canoes in the streets. Over 230 Americans have died in flooding since 2015. Many more perished around the world as extreme precipitation events pop up on every continent. But what if extreme precipitation gets even worse as the world warms? What if rains beyond our experience swamp the infrastructure of cities or wipes out crops? A new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences seems to predict that is exactly what will happen. Our guest is the lead author, Dr. J. David Neelan. He's a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at the University of California in Los Angeles. Neelan has published over 150 papers during the past few decades. David Neelan is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the American Geophysical Union. He leads UCLA's Climate Systems Interaction Group. David Neelan, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
Well, you've done such deep research into both atmospheric science and the behavior of oceans, it's tempting to say you're a kind of hybrid specialist. Is that true?
Yeah, my group first made its name working on El Nino and taking apart why we get these warm and cold events down in the Pacific every 2 to 5 years, typically, and some of the implications of that. And this is an example where universities figured out a phenomenon, and then that got turned over to the National Weather Service, among other places, for routine forecasts that we now have, some of which are right and some of which occasionally are wrong.
Well, that's the way weather forecasting goes. Now, to prepare the stage for our conversation today, there have already been papers looking into the relationship of extreme precipitation and a warming world. And I'm thinking of the work by Dr. Paul A. O'Gorman, for example, or Lehmann's paper from the Potsdam Institute in Germany. That was titled Increased Record-Breaking Precipitation Events Under Global Warming. David, what sets your new paper apart?
Yes, it's important to situate this in a long track record of work on precipitation and how we project based on climate models that will change in the future, and also work on trends in extreme precipitation that have occurred over the past decades. So it's not a new thing to say that the extremes of precipitation are going to increase. What we looked at specifically is accumulations of precipitation from when you start raining to when you stop raining. So precipitation accumulations, and that would be in millimeters if you're a scientist, in inches if you're an American. And one of the questions has been that if the intensity of rainfall increases. So you get more millimeters in an hour. Do you rain shorter, or do you keep raining and get more rain over the course of the event? And our study specifically addresses that, sure enough, you accumulate more over the course of an event. And we did two things. We were looking at a theoretical point of view where we can derive some things from the moisture equation of the atmosphere, governing how much moisture you have in the atmosphere. That in the first place, we were just interested in explaining something in current observations. And as we were doing it, we realized that this implied that the accumulation should increase in a rather specific way. The probabilities of large accumulations should increase in a rather specific way under global warming. It's consistent with what you expect from the work on intensities or daily averaged rainfall that's happened, and it puts another piece in the puzzle.
What I found different in this work, and really I had to work through two stages to understand it, and the first is the principle that there's been a limit to the amount of rain that can fall from the sky in a certain period, and you call that a cutoff point, and sounds like a good thing, maybe nature's way of keeping us from drowning. Can you explain what those limits are?
Sure. So if you think about your accumulations, how much rainfall fell from when you first felt that drop of rain to when it's not necessarily the sky cleared up, but it was no longer raining, you put down your umbrella. It's really common to have, say, an event in which a fraction of a millimeter would fall. And then if you go up to an event where the accumulation would be, say, a couple of millimeters, that's still pretty probable, maybe a little less than a tenth is probable. And then you go up another factor of 10, you know, to 10 millimeters, that's substantially less probable. But still, you know, you're going down by about a factor of 10, a little more than a factor of 10 each time you go up to the factor of 10 larger event. That's known as a power law. And then at a certain scale, certain number of millimeters that's typical for each region on the planet, the tropics would be different than, say, mid-latitude North America, you reach a scale at which your probability starts to drop about exponentially, i.e. pretty fast. So your number of events you experience larger than that cutoff is much, much less probable than the range of occurrences that you would get on the smaller accumulations.
Well, then comes the second stage, and this is really the worrying part, is that this cutoff limit will change as the world warms. Could you tell us about that?
Yep, and this is it's essentially taking things that are already known and twisting them to apply specifically to this accumulation, how much falls in a given event. You have a certain amount of moisture variability in the atmosphere. The large-scale motion of the atmosphere is converging moisture, and that tends you to drive you up till you get to high enough moisture that you start raining out. And what we found is that the range of the smaller events is governed by the statistics of those moisture convergence fluctuations. And then you get up to a point where the amount of rain that you have dropped out really enters into the equations, and that sets the scale for any given region. So it's a trade-off between these fluctuations and the fact that you're raining, you're losing water from the atmosphere. As you increase the amount of water vapor that's in the atmosphere, you tend to increase the size of those moisture fluctuations, and that pushes your range where your probability of larger events drops slowly up to a slightly higher value. Your cutoff occurs at a higher value.
Well, I can remember a couple of years ago, Great Britain was hit with a string of superstorms, and drainage systems that worked since Victorian times completely failed, and some villages that hadn't flooded since the Middle Ages went under. So, David Neelan, are you saying we can expect to see more record rains in parts of the world?
Yes, this is what this is saying. And it's consistent with, you know, quite a number of other studies that have looked at this from different point of views. So it's putting another piece in this puzzle with a little more theoretical underpinning, and then a rather large ensemble of climate model simulations to look at the way that this does change in a full complex climate model that includes representations of all the weather events that you would have.
And there's a word in your paper I had to revisit because it's not something we use every day. If we want to grasp what precipitation modeling can and can't do, we can't avoid that term stochastic. What does stochastic mean and how does that affect your work?
Yes, so stochastic essentially means a process that you're representing as having a random component, one where you can't predict the precise fluctuations from moment to moment, although you are able to say things about the statistics. And we borrowed a big chunk of theory from the physics literature that uses these stochastic processes. And we use this to make statements about the way the statistics of extreme rainfall will change, even though you don't expect to be able to predict a century in advance the exact weather patterns. You're treating those as effectively random on timescales longer than a week or so, but you're still looking at the way that their statistics will evolve. And that was used in the theoretical prediction part of the study. And I have to say that theory was motivated by just understanding observations we had made using the Department of Energy has these wonderful data sets from high-resolution measurements of rainfall at many places in the world. And that's where we were first noticing this rather simple distribution of probabilities of the accumulations. They were, in observations, having this slow drop as you went up, each factor of 10 in size, and then this fast drop. And so when we were explaining that using the stochastic model, we realized that there were these implications for global warming. We went and took the National Center for Atmospheric Research large climate model and ran 15 runs in normal climate of 30 years each and then 15 runs in a high greenhouse gas scenario for future climate and looked at the differences between the accumulations in those future scenario runs versus the current runs, the current historical greenhouse gas runs.
You know, I really appreciated that explanation. I've understood your paper better for hearing that. I've noticed that the arrival of extreme precipitation events has been very uneven. The Potsdam Institute reports hazardous rain increased by about 12% globally, but in Southeast Asia, the increase was 56%. Why are some regions magnets for extreme precipitation, like the U.S. Deep South, while others are not?
Some of that has to do with the particular types of weather system that they get in each region and the ways that that can change. So if you, for instance, have a change in the timing of your deep convective rainfall of a monsoon system, for example, that changes in a way that can potentially be slightly different than our mid-latitude rainfall that comes from frontal systems. But we have to say we don't understand everything about the regional changes at this point. You're essentially, when you're asking questions about global warming, the question of is the planet warming when you put increased infrared radiation trapping gases in the atmosphere, that one's relatively easy. The question of, you know, exactly for my specific region, how is the rainfall going to change in this particular year, that's a tougher one. So we tend to make these statements that apply across broad regions.
Well, you know, just for fun, I looked up the largest amount of rain that's fallen in any American state since records began, and it was 42 inches over a meter of rain that fell in 24 hours in Texas. That was in July 1979. But it turns out measuring rainfall isn't as easy as it sounds. There are things that can distort the whole process. What are the best tools now for counting how much rain falls in a particular place or region?
So there's a number of measurement methods. There's various types of local rain gauge, from things that are essentially glorified buckets to with, you know, careful wind sheltering and so on, to optical gauges that count how many raindrops are falling past a sensor. And those are at the ground-based station level. And then there's a large investment in satellite technology for measuring rainfall from space. Those are always estimates based on the amount of raindrops and their effects on the either microwave radiation coming up from the clouds, for instance, or in some cases we have space-based radar on satellites that essentially ping and look at the hydrometeors in the clouds and estimate the rain rate from that. And the satellites have great spatial coverage, and then you're typically checking them against the ground-based observations to calibrate the rates. You like to make statements when you're doing things from observations that combine all of these data sets.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. And our guest, David Nealon, was educated at the University of Toronto before getting his doctorate from Princeton. He's been at the University of California, Los Angeles for quite a while. And we're talking about new science showing extreme precipitation is coming as we disrupt the climate. Well, it seems to me you're beyond just using computer models. You're expert enough to evaluate different models and their shortcomings. Some people are suspicious of computer modeling and climate science. How can we have some confidence in the work that you've done?
So one of the significant things that I, for instance, always tell my students is you don't necessarily want to put all your faith in one single study, and certainly not in one single model run or one single set of observations. You're always looking at an aggregate of multiple studies by multiple groups on the same thing. And in the case of the increases in precipitation, that's why I was mentioning the background of multiple other research groups that have looked at this both in observational trends and in predictions from the climate model over the, basically now we're talking about almost two decades that this has been looked at. And so we're gradually making our statements with increasing confidence about the increased probability of very large precipitation events.
Looking back through your past papers, it's a pretty impressive work. You've gone into such large and complicated problems, and my guess is that only grad students can really carry on those kinds of conversations. If you go to a party and somebody asks what you do for a living, David, what do you tell them?
At first I would tell them about El Nino, which sort of hit the public scene around 1997, more than a decade after we started working on it. Now, if you tell them you're a climate scientist, they have plenty of things to ask you about, so that's not really a problem. I teach a undergraduate class in climate modeling and climate change that started out maybe 15 years ago with 7 students and now has to be capped at 120. So this is definitely something that you can talk about at the undergraduate level. And I sort of pride myself with being able to have conversations on this across the political spectrum. I find if you calmly explain what you know and why you know it, that people listen, people get it, at least in one-on-one conversation.
Okay, well, to me, this is really jaw-dropping science. I mean, destructive and deadly rains are coming as we alter the atmosphere. How do you feel about it?
I do want to put some perspective on this in that the changes in probability of a really large event that we're, for instance, finding in the climate model, they're increasing by hundreds of percent by the end of the century under a scenario where we do little to limit the emissions of greenhouse gas. If you limit the emissions of greenhouse gas, you would limit the increase in the probability of these large events. And I'm an optimist. It's taking a long time. The first big study that came out on global warming summarizing the existing science was in 1979. So it's been a long road, but there's much more awareness now. And even if one could wish for faster action, I do have confidence that society as a whole, people will step up and do sensible things to evolve our energy infrastructure over time and invest in cleaner technology.
Well, you must have several research balls juggling in the air at any particular time. David Neelan, could you talk to us about what you're working on now or hope to tackle in the near future?
We have a lot of research on the fundamentals of precipitation processes. And one of the things that one is always working at is improving the way climate models simulate this, and weather model forecast models for that matter. At this point, the weather forecast models and the climate models are very, very closely related to each other. So we work back and forth. As I mentioned, we do some theoretical work, but we also have a big observational effort where, for instance, we're taking data from Department of Energy field programs, for example, or many of the satellite data sets that are now available from NASA and NOAA satellites. We're scrutinizing in a detailed level exactly how the precipitation onsets when you have a given temperature and moisture structure in the atmosphere, for instance, with an aim of using this to fine-tune, improve the representations of these processes in the climate models.
And what does the Climate Systems Interaction Group at UCLA do, and what sort of computing power do you have available to you?
So one of the great things is that the National Center for Atmospheric Research, among other institutions, as well as some of the Department of Energy laboratories, they maintain large supercomputer infrastructure, and you can apply for time on that, computing time on that. So we do most of our big computing using collaborative infrastructure, collaborative computing infrastructure, and collaborative models that are have hundreds of scientists contributing to their maintenance and improvement. So you can have a graduate student hop on to a very sophisticated climate model like the National Center for Atmospheric Research model and be able to modify the particular thing that they want to improve and get a run going without having to individually maintain that infrastructure.
Well, you don't have to answer this next question, but I'm wondering, you say you're an optimist. Do you think the new Trump administration will succeed in dampening American climate research to any degree?
My graduate students have been asking the same thing. You know, I like to think that sensible, when it comes down to it, people tend to make sensible decisions. And so I'm optimistic that there'll still be room for research. By and large, the U.S. has been fairly good about not having politics interfere at the level of scientific research over the past, and I'm hoping that some of that continues. In any case, even if society makes decisions to not move quickly to limit greenhouse gas emissions, that's a decision society can make. We, you know, we're in a democracy, and the climate scientist's job will only become more important if we decide to do more rapid global warming than we have been, because we'll need to know with more precision what those consequences are going to be that we will have to adapt to.
Well, and my feeling, too, is that American climate science has been pretty advanced. I mean, there's great science in other parts of the world. We know that. But American scientists have led in many fields. And I think there's so much momentum in that that I don't think a four-year term, and I'm hoping that's what it might be, can really draw the strings on that, can really slow it down that much. And if it does, it'll bounce back very quickly.
One of the other things that is worth mentioning is that climate science isn't just about global warming. You know, for instance, I mentioned much of my early work was on El Nino and its consequences, and that's a natural climate variation. Much of the statements about extreme rainfall and, for instance, the work to improve weather and climate models, that is every bit as useful for weather prediction, which has, you know, substantial use to people across society. They're the same tools of the same graduate students working on these natural climate variations as are looking at, okay, what happens to these weather variations when you warm the climate? There's no distinction because you're working on the same phenomenon and how it tilts under natural variability or how it tilts under human-induced climate change.
All right, we're going to have to wrap this up. Is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
One of the interesting research frontiers at the moment is one of attribution of probability of specific events to climate change. That's something that you'll be hearing more and more in the news, and it's worth taking a listen to that. These are early days in that. My group is not directly engaged in that, but we know groups that are, and we know the tools that they use. And that's as we move forward more and more into the warming era. You know, we just had another record for the global average temperature this past year in 2016, and there's every reason to think that that will keep going. That thinking about how this is impacting specific groups in society, who is in harm's way when you have a greater probability of a flood event, when the 1-in-100-year event becomes a 1-in-20-year event, what are the consequences of that? Those are things that it's worth paying attention to from a point of view of adapting your infrastructure, what municipalities need to do to invest in their infrastructure, what are the business impacts, opportunities, and risks. Those are all things where it's worth listening carefully to what's being said.
We've been discussing the paper, Global Warming, Precipitation Accumulation Increases Above the Current Climate Cutoff Scale. The lead author is Professor J. David Nealon from the University of California. This paper contains a warning about precipitation events getting even more extreme as we warm the planet. You can find links to the science we've discussed and to Dr. Nealon and his lab in my show blog at ecoshock.org. David Nealon, thank you so much for sharing your time with us on Radio EcoShock.
No, thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Then it rained 40 days and nights without stopping. Wow. Noah was worried when the rain kept a dropping. Wow. He sent out a raven, he sent out a dove. Wow. The water grew God, he kept a coming from above. Wow. The timid little children, the bird did seek. Wow. But he couldn't find a land to rest his beak.
Well, Noah wasn't worried about the resting his feet, but he couldn't hear the angels moan.
Well, didn't it
rain?
Sure.
Send the water from Zion.
He's gonna rain.
Heaven up higher. It's gonna rain.
The old gospel tune, Didn't It Rain, was recorded by the fabulous Jim Burns and the Sojourners live in Ghent, Belgium on Saturday, March 27, 2010. It's something to enjoy, and I'll put a link to that YouTube video in my blog at ecoshock.org. You can find my notes and links on these two interviews in my show blog for the summer at ecoshock.org. You can also download this program and pass it on to others. We will all need to pay attention to those boring government plans to handle new floods in a different climate. And if your community does not have a plan, you may have to get one going. As we enter the most challenging period of human existence, and this is it, we must be able to handle several threats at the same time. Like COVID-19, climate change does not go away if we pretend it is a hoax, if we want to delay it for 10 years, or we'll get around to it eventually. Reality is reality, and it will strike. Thank you for taking the time to learn about overland flooding as climate change ramps up. This is a problem that takes patience, it takes years of preparation, and a will to survive. I'm Alex Smith. Tune in next week for more critical information on Radio EcoShock.
Well, all the wind did blow, the ark did rock, and Noah couldn't find nowhere to dock. My God spoke, whispered low, showed old Noah where he wanted that to go. He said, look here, Noah, the rain's done stopped. I want you to land on the mountaintop. Showed old Noah a rainbow sign. He said, it won't be rain, but fire next time.
Well, Noah wasn't worried about the fire next time, but he wanted to hear the angels moan.
But didn't it rain?
Children's